Welcome back. We're ready to finish our introduction to stocks with a discussion on the types of common stocks. Just the major categories, folks. There are more. And we'll also take a look at market capitalization, fancy way of saying how big is your company, and then end with some stock investing strategies and styles. So let's get started on slide number 75, types of common stocks. The biggest and the most well-established companies are called blue chip stocks, financially strong, high-quality stocks with long and stable records of earnings and dividends, often increasing their dividends over time. They are often referred to as value stocks, although be careful, value and growth have these connotations that we'll discuss in a few slides. They tend to attract conservative investors, and I'm not talking about politics, folks. I'm talking about people who don't want to lose their money. Examples: General Electric, General Motors. For decades, these two companies were stalwarts, huge corporations that could be depended upon for solid earnings. Yeah, well, you know what happened to GE, don't you? Well, maybe you don't, but General Electric is a very large company, and they just don't make light bulbs, folks. They moved more and more into the world of finance, and before the crash of 2008, they were making more money off of finance than they were off of jet engines and power plants. And by the way, they used to own NBC, and then a long time ago, they used to own ABC too. And then, boy, did they get hammered in the 2008-2009 turmoil. But they're coming back, folks. They're coming back. General Motors, they're gone. Well, the old General Motors is gone, right? That company has disappeared, and the new General Motors seems to be doing okay, sort of fine. We'll see in a few years. So who are the blue chips of today? Right, now we have companies like Walmart and McDonald's and Procter and Gamble and others, Exxon, Microsoft, and the tech companies such as Intel and Cisco. Where does the term blue chip come from, by the way? Well, it comes from the time when only gentlemen owned stocks, not the common hoi polloi, the commoners. And gentlemen not only owned stocks, they also gambled. That's what a gentleman did. And blue chips on the gambling tables were the most expensive chips. I don't think they are anymore. And that's where the name came from, believe it or not. Income stocks, often associated, but not always the same as blue chips. Income stocks are stocks with long and sustained records of paying higher than average dividends. Again, sometimes people refer to them as value stocks, but be careful. These are normally slow growth companies in mature industries. And who are the examples? Well, utilities. Yes, they're the poster child, the archetype of an income stock. Are utilities growing? No, unless the area that they're in is growing quickly. No, but do people want to take cold showers in the dark? No, they want the lights on and they want their water hot and their house warm. So they are consistently paying income. Now, for many decades, banks were in this category. Right, and so they got incredibly greedy and did some really stupid things with our money. Slide number 76. Growth stocks. Okay. The growth stocks, they're the companies with the good-looking teeth and the beautiful hair and the muscles, and they're on the cover of Gentleman's Quarterly and Vogue magazine. These are stocks that experience high rates of growth in operations and earnings. Growth rate 15-20%. Often associated with high price to earnings ratios. Why? Because investors are optimistic about their future prospects. Often no dividends at all, or a very small token amount. Why? Because most of the profits are being reinvested into the company. The stock price should go up, yes, but it's going to be very volatile, because as soon as the growth in that company starts to slow, many growth-oriented investors will just hammer the stock. They will just dump it. Shoot now, ask questions later. And some examples of these are Intel, Microsoft, Dell. Wait a minute. Are Intel, Microsoft, and Dell, are they still growth stocks? Well, sure, they're still growing, but not like they were 20 years ago. They've become blue chips, right? And they've started to pay pretty, at least Microsoft and Intel, pay pretty decent dividends. Yes. They've gone through their major growth spurt and now have become big companies. So who are the growth stocks today? Right, the social disease media, the social media companies such as LinkedIn and Facebook and of course Google and Apple are the growth stocks. Right, they're on the cover of Time and. Yeah, right. Slide number 77. We've got to come to grips with these terms, folks, because you have to be careful. Growth versus value. The investment world loves to use the terms growth and value, but the meanings of the terms are not exact. Typically, investors often use the term growth to designate a high PE stock, while they use the term value to denote a low PE stock. But you know what, folks? A high PE stock might be a great value, while a low PE stock might not be a good value. You see, I use the term value when I see something that, to my mind, has value, is a good deal, is something that I'm interested in and attractive, and I feel has a good long-term a good long-term outlook. Does that make sense? It may be a high PE stock, price to earnings ratio might be a low PE stock. And here's a wonderful example from a few years back. In January of 2005, Google was selling for around $200 a share with a sky-high PE. I think it was in the 60s. While General Motors was selling for $34, but a very low PE and a huge dividend. Well, today, Google sells for around $600. I think it's fallen a little bit, $580 or something like that, but with a much lower PE. The old GM stock that was $34 is selling for 4 cents. You don't believe me, look it up. It's called Liquidation Motors. That's the old GM, the old GM. And it's going to take several years for them to unwind all those assets and liabilities. But it will be eventually liquidated and will become worthless. So which one was the better value in January of 2005? Exactly. I agree with you. I think it was Google. But investors would say, no, that's a growth stock, not a value stock, and GM was a value stock, even though it became almost valueless. So make sure you understand that people are going to use the terms to designate high PE, low PE, and the term value for them doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good value. And of course, value is in the eye of the beholder. Slide 78. On the other side of the coin from growth stocks are what we call cyclical stocks. Cyclicals. These are companies whose earnings and overall market performance are closely linked to the general state of the economy. They follow the business cycle of advances and declines. If the economy does well, they do well. If the economy does poorly, well, so do they. And the poster child, the prime example of a cyclical stock, is the automobile industry. When the economy's doing well, people are getting better jobs and raises, and unemployment's down, what do? They run out and buy a new car. Is the old car still working? Sure, but I want a new car. I got a new job. Geniuses. I don't know how they figured that out, but I guess this is part of our culture. When the economy's not doing well, old Bessie's just fine, thank you very much. I don't need a new car. And it turns out that any company that makes stuff, timber, steel, chemicals, is a cyclical. Because when there's an uptick in the economy, there's more stuff being built and created, and houses and cars and everything else. And so there's more of a need for materials and the stuff that is created from those materials. And so what's happened to Intel and Cisco? Right, they've become cyclicals. Now when the economy's growing, businesses are expanding, housing is expanding, and we need more stuff, and virtually all the stuff you buy these days, even shoes, microwaves, refrigerators, computers, has chips in it. And of course, if the economy expands, so does the internet, so we need Cisco routers. So these tech companies have become cyclical companies. On the other side of the cyclicals are what we call defensive stocks. These are stocks that tend to hold their own and even do well when the economy starts to falter. They remain stable during declines in the market, usually, or they don't go down as much. And they're often associated with income stocks, and some people call them value stocks, so be careful. And these are companies like Kellogg's. Food. Are you going to eat less Cheerios or less Corn Flakes because the economy's doing poorly? Are you going to eat more? And Procter & Gamble, soap, toilet paper, toothpaste, diapers. Exactly. You're not going to wash yourself more because the economy's doing well, and hopefully you're not going to wash yourself less because the economy's doing well. Also, drug companies are in this defensive, but they have a few little dynamics on their own. But are you going to take more insulin if the economy does well, or are you going to take less insulin? Yeah. So defensive stocks, they sort of sit in the corner and don't do much when the economy's rip roaring. But when the economy falters, they tend to shine compared to other stocks because of that defensive nature. Very popular with equity income funds. Remember equity income mutual funds? Yeah. Slide number 79, turnaround stocks. Well, I call them goners, usually, because they usually don't come back. But if there is a potential for a rebound, oh boy, can you make money. These are companies that have fallen on hard times. Most of you weren't alive. But in the early 1980s, Chrysler almost disappeared, folks. And you boomers and you traditionalists, you remember this, and maybe some of you Gen Xers. The company needed a bailout. Well, it didn't really get a bailout, folks. But what it did get were guaranteed loans from banks, guaranteed by the taxpayer. So if they had eventually disappeared, the taxpayer would have been on the hook. But it turned out they did rebound. And so the stock went from 40-something down to 3. And then a few years later, some of you might want to take a look at a gentleman by the name of Lee Iacocca, who was the guy who actually, he used to work for Ford, and he was the guy who got the Ford Mustang. You know, he didn't. He was the project manager, the person behind it. I don't know if he actually designed the thing, but a very popular car. And then he worked for Chrysler during their turnaround. He worked for a dollar the first year. And of course, no, he didn't work for a dollar. He got lots of stocks and lots of stock options and he did very well for himself. But he deserved it. He was able to turn around Chrysler and save tens of thousands of jobs. And now, they're in the same boat, aren't they? Chrysler, Ford, GM, they're trying to turn themselves around. And so far, so good. You know, a lot of people are very angry at Chrysler and GM because they took government money. They've paid it all back. Relax. And Ford, they were geniuses. The gentleman who is the CEO of Ford is a very smart guy. Jim Mullally. Jim Mullally. I got his name right. I hope I did. He scrambled and begged and borrowed and stole every dime he could to make sure that Ford didn't have to take any government money to get them through the hard times. And it, boy, did it work out for them. Why? Because people walk into a Ford dealership and say, I bought GMs all my life, and yeah, I'm going to buy a Ford because you didn't take any government money. Well, you see, Ford played that game knowing full well that if GM and Chrysler hadn't taken the money, they would have gone under. Why? Because if GM and Chrysler had gone under, that means the people, the companies that supply the parts to Chrysler, GM, and Ford would have gone under, so Ford would have gone under. So boy, didn't they play that perfectly. They played that as if they were virtuosos. Asset play stocks. These are companies that are sitting on an asset that could be sold or spun off. And a great example of this is JCPenney's. You know, you think of JCPenney's as a you know, department store. And that's what it is. But no, it has other businesses. And in the late 90s, early 2000s, the department stores were in trouble, folks. And a lot of them are gone. Remember Robinson's May and Montgomery Ward's and the Broadway and Merval, that fabulously exclusive French department store, which was associated with Target, but Target sold them off, and then Mervyn's went out of business. Well, JCPenney's was hurting. Why? Because all of them were hurting. They were getting hit from the bottom by the Walmarts of the world, and they were getting hit from the top by the needless markups and the Nordstroms of the world. But JCPenney's had, and still has, an insurance division, very profitable. They're the ones that sell you really worthless insurance for your kids, that could have easily been sold to raise cash to have kept the company afloat, if need be. So they still have it. So there. And asset plays are a little hard. You have to dig underneath the surface to understand the company. Another example of that is Pepsi. And we already talked about Yum Brands. They own another major company that you may have heard of, Frito-Lay, exactly. So Pepsi, they're never going to sell it, I don't think. Maybe they'll spin it off someday, I don't know. But yeah, so asset plays are a little tricky, yeah. Penny stocks. Oh boy, penny stocks. Folks, you know, these things should not even be discussed in polite company. These are the scams of the world. Remember the OTC bulletin board and the OTC pink sheets? Folks, that's where these companies, those are the places that these companies infest. The wrong side of the tracks, the red light district, the bad side of town. And in the face-to-face class, we would now jump over to the website and take a look at some examples. So you go on the website and take a look at some of the examples of penny stocks. Folks, you're going to see these advertisements. They're on Yahoo's. Yahoo's trying to make a living, so they'll take advertising from anybody. But these people are scam artists. They're not real companies. Yeah. Enough said. Stay away. Okay, what's going on here? Let me get to the next slide. Foreign stocks, international stocks. Well, you know, folks, traditionally this was difficult for investors in the United States. You basically had to have an account in Japan or Europe, and then change your dollars into yen or dollars into fresh French francs or German marks. Well, now the Europe uses the euro. And so more and more brokerage firms are making it very easier, for you to conduct business in other parts of the world. But mostly what people used to do, and still do, is buy American depository receipts. So you can buy shares in Sony or Toyota. But wait a minute, those are Japanese companies. And you can buy, I think you can still buy shares on the New York Stock Exchange in Telmex. That's a Mexican company. How does that work? Well, a Wall Street investment bank or major trust company or other bank will go to Japan and buy a ton of shares of Sony. And then they'll bring them to the United States and then reissue them dollar denominated in what are called depository receipts. Sometimes you'll see them GDRs, global depository receipts. So you get to buy these things in dollars. And so you don't have to worry about currency issues. Of course, most of us are going to use mutual funds because it's just so much easier. Remember the difference between global and international. Global means everybody including the United States. International, everyone except the United States. And what you have to think about, and just you don't worry about it too much because the world is becoming more and more intertwined, currency issues. Currency issues. Because when you buy shares in another country, in their currency, you are at the whims of the currency going up and down. If the dollar becomes stronger, all other things being equal, and of course they never are, your investment goes down. Huh? Yeah, because it takes more yen or more euros or more pesos to buy your dollars. If the dollar becomes weaker, all other things being equal, and of course they never are, your investment will go up. Because now it takes fewer pesos, or fewer euros, or fewer Japanese yen to buy our dollar. So the question for international and global investors is, will the dollar be stronger or weaker in the coming years? And oh boy, isn't that a whole can of worms. Well, the truth is, nobody knows. I believe, for what it's worth, that the dollar will be weaker, on the weaker side over the next coming years. And why is that? Because we import so much damn oil. And we know we need to reduce our dependency, our addiction to oil. We're not going to get rid of it, folks. I'm not trying to say everybody should be riding bicycles. Actually, I do. I do think everyone should ride a bicycle, but that's me. There are some people that believe that the dollar is going to completely collapse. Absolutely become worthless. You know, it could. Anything is possible. They point to the Federal Reserve Bank flooding the world with dollars. Okay, yes, it's an issue, and the Fed knows that they have to do something when the economy turns around, but they're waiting for the economy to turn around. And there are people who are saying, well, it's never going to turn around. We're going down the tubes. You know, that's always a possibility. Get out there and get to work and make sure it doesn't happen. But more and more the world is global. If the dollar did become worthless, folks, what a horrible time we would have to live through. Because it wouldn't just hurt us. It would hurt the whole world. So if you're really interested in this, there are plenty of places to go and look at the differing points of view. One gentleman who is very much in this camp goes by the name of Peter Schiff. I mean, that's his name, Peter Schiff. And he's one of the pundits on the talk shows and the interviews with investors and the like. So check him out. Another gentleman who's I believe is a scam artist is Porter Stansberry. So just, you know, type these things in and you'll see dozens and millions of hits, and he's just trying to scare people silly. And I think I put a link. I think I did. Maybe I'll do it again and find it. I think it was on the old website, right? It's on the old, not on the new spiffy website. So check out what Mr. Stansberry says about the future of the late great United States. Enough. Slide number 81. Market capitalization. Capitalization? Yeah, this is a fancy term for how big is your company. And it's a very simple calculation. You take the current price of the stock times the number of shares outstanding. And this tells you how much the company is worth. You see, people tend to fixate, they tend to concentrate on the price of the stock. The price of the stock is meaningless for the most part until you get to penny stocks where they're a few cents a share. You don't know how much the company is worth until you take that price of the stock and multiply it times the number of shares outstanding. And there are three categories: large cap, mid cap, and small cap. And folks, haven't we already seen these when we were discussing mutual funds? Yes. And you can think of them, it's up to you, as the papa bears, the mommy bears, and the baby bears. No Goldilocks. Okay. So large cap companies are anything above 10 billion and up. That's a big company, folks. And most of these companies you have heard of, you know their products. Some of them you haven't heard of, you don't know their products, but that's okay. Once you get into the hundreds of billions, once you get over about $100 billion, and that's a big company, folks, then you are in a subcategory of large cap stocks, and those are called mega cap. And you don't have to remember that, but you'll hear it. You'll hear it. Oh, yeah, that Walmart, that's a mega cap stock. A GE is a mega cap stock. But it's still a large cap. It's a subcategory. The mid-cap companies, anywhere from about $2 billion or so up to about $10 billion. And you've heard of many of these, and most of these you probably have not heard of. But they're still pretty big companies, but they're in the mid-sized range. And then the small-cap companies. Anything from about $100 million to $1 or $2 billion. There's a subcategory of small cap stocks, and those are called micro cap. 50 million and below, up to about 100 million. Even 10 million, it could be a micro cap. But once you start getting below that, then you get into the world of the penny stocks, folks. And folks, stay away, stay far away from these things, because most of these are just scams. And as I already mentioned, check out the website for a couple of examples and advertisements from the people who are trying to scam you about these things. Just stay away. People say, oh, you can make a 10,000% in just a few days, and you can lose all of it in the next day. Yeah, stay away. Slide number 82. Here's an example. Our $20 stock, if there were 5 million shares to do the calculation, and you don't have to do the calculation, it's right there when you look up the stock. You take $20 times the number of shares, 5 million, and you get a market capitalization of 100 million. This is a small cap stock. And as we said, the stock price, for the most part, until you get to the mini, the penny stock, is irrelevant. You must look at the market capitalization to see what the value of the company is. Remember Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway? $120,000 a share? Right. There are far fewer shares. Of course, because he never split the stock. Right. You got it. Slide number 83. So let's take a look at some examples. Walmart and Target. A couple little grocery stores on the corner that you may... Five and Dimes, you may have heard of. Oh, by the way, they got rid of the star. Or they put it at the end or something like that. It used to be the name of the company was Wall Star Mart, but now they sort of moved it at the end. I have to change that. You look at the price, and this is February 2nd, $61.94 for Walmart and $52 for Target. Now, if you just looked at the price, you might think, well, they're about the same size. But no, you know intuitively which one's larger, right? Walmart is much larger than Target. Walmart is global. Target is still based in the United States, doesn't have any stores, and maybe a few in Canada, but no, they have not ventured forth into the world yet. So what we need to do is we need to look at the number of shares outstanding. And it turns out that Walmart has 3.42 billion, almost 3.5 billion shares, and Target only has about 671.6 million shares, right? So if you do the multiplication, and you don't have to because it's on the website, whichever website you use, Yahoo, Bloomberg, CBS, MarketWatch, you do that and you find out that Walmart, yeah, it's about, what, 7 times the size of Target? Yeah, $212.95 billion. Whereas Target is almost $35 billion. In other words, folks, if you wanted to buy Walmart, if you wanted to buy the company, you would have to come up with over $200 billion. As of February 2nd, $212.95 billion to be exact. But in reality, would you need just that amount? No, because as soon as you started to buy every bid, every ask, asking price, every offer that was made by all the people selling their shares of Walmart, what would happen? Right, the price would start climbing because obviously, no matter what price I throw out, someone's bidding for it. So for that reason, that's not how companies are taken over. What normally happens is, if there's a bona fide offer, and folks, nobody's going to buy Walmart. Nobody has $100, $200 and some billion. But you'd have to go to the, in this case, the New York Stock Exchange, and they have a method, they have a set methodology for doing this. They would say, okay, you want to buy Walmart. What kind of premium, what kind of offer are you prepared to make? And you'd have to come up with about $240 billion. You'd get 10% premium, sometimes more, sometimes less. And so, now this is very, very sensitive information. And so they have a set procedure for bringing this to the marketplace. And of course, as soon as it is announced, if investors believe it's a bona fide offer, then the price will zoom right up to the tender offer price, or pretty darn close. If they think that the company or the individual or the private equity group or whoever it is trying to put together the offer is just bluffing or not able to, then they'll just ignore it. It won't just zoom up to that price. You understand? Yeah. Okay, so Target is a whole lot smaller than Walmart. But by looking at the price, you just wouldn't know. So we have to look at the number of shares outstanding. Specifically, we look at the market capitalization. Slide number 84. Here's a couple other small little telecommunications companies you may have heard of. AT&T and Verizon, a duopoly. And it looks as though the AT&T's attempt to buy T-Mobile from Deutsche Telekom isn't going to work out. So I don't know what Deutsche Telekom is going to do, because long ago they realized that they were never going to get big enough in the United States to really make a ton of money. So they've been trying to extricate themselves ever since, and we'll see what happens. Kind of stuck here, which is not a bad thing to do, but they just don't have the... these two companies, AT&T and Verizon, are just so huge. And Sprint, I don't know how they're hanging on, but I hope they don't go under. Just because you want more competition out there, in my personal opinion. That's my personal opinion. Look at the prices. AT&T is $29.79 as of February 2nd. Verizon, $37.50. So you might think, wait a minute, is Verizon bigger than AT&T? What do you think? No. They're both pretty big, but AT&T is bigger than Verizon. It is. There are almost 6 billion shares of AT&T, while a little less than 3 billion shares of Verizon. So the market capitalization of each is very large, folks. Don't get me wrong. I mean, Verizon is a pretty big company. In fact, they're both mega cap, large cap companies. But AT&T is $176.5 billion of market capitalization, and Verizon is $106.5 billion. So, yes, both are very large companies, and they're not going anywhere. But we call it a duopoly. Have you heard that? Not a monopoly, but a duopoly, where two companies are basically calling the shots for the marketplace. Now, slide number 85. Let's turn our attention to some investment strategies. And in chapters 6 and 17, we'll get into more analysis techniques and valuation techniques. But here are just some investment strategies from a much higher perspective, if you will. The buy and hold strategy. This strategy, we use fundamental analysis, and what is that? We'll discuss that in Chapter 6, to identify high-quality companies with good growth prospects and potential for dividends at reasonable prices. And then it goes by other names such as value investing. Some people sometimes say deep value investing. Growth at a reasonable price, GARP. GARP, which used to be it is a good book, The World According to GARP, and they made it into a movie, which was not as good as the book. Read the book. And you hold on to the stock for the long term. And they once asked Warren Buffett, because he's a buy and hold in the investment. He uses the buy and hold investment strategy. And they said, well, Mr. Buffett, how long ideally should you hold on to a stock? And he said, you hold it forever. Well, now he's being facetious because you don't live forever. But, hey, you can hold it forever. And as if you remember, those of you who watched the video, the interview with Mr. Bogle from Vanguard with Steve Forbes back in Chapter 1, he said the same thing. You basically buy the company companies that you're interested in, and you take advantage of the fruits of the company forever. You just basically hold it forever. Now, obviously, in your older years, you're going to start liquidating, whether you give it away because you have so much you don't know what to do with, such as Mr. Buffett, or you bequeath some of it to your children or your heirs. That's your decision. When I was at this one seminar talking about liquidating IRAs, and they had another scheme for using life insurance, which my understanding is not quite kosher with the IRS, but they were talking about leaving $1 million at least, or so such and such, because that was at the time that was the maximum you could leave to somebody without paying any estate taxes. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. I raised my hand and said, well, you know, I don't know about you, but my son, our son, he gets the house when we die, he gets an education, and after that, he's on his own. I want to spend it all. Anyway, I digress. So I'm a buy and hold kind of guy. My personal favorite. So I tell you right up front what my bias is. And there's a wonderful example on the website called Don't Lose Perspective. And of course, in the face-to-face class, I would show it to you now, but you can pause this, go there and take a look at it. It's a little presentation and audio commentary and the like. So check it out. Slide number 86, the income strategy. Remember, equity income emphasizes dividends over capital appreciation. Ideally, we are looking for growth of dividends. We're looking for companies that consistently grow their dividends because, as we've noted, companies that pay consistently growing dividends tend to do well when the market as a whole does poorly. So in general, this strategy, income, is appropriate for conservative stock investors. And again, we're not talking about politics. We're talking about people who don't want to lose their money. This strategy works well with dividend reinvestment plans. DRIPS, excellent vehicle. Stocks which have had histories of consistent dividend increases have often been the market's best long-term investments. Yeah. Slide number 87, the growth strategy. Yay! Investing in stocks with above-average forecasts of earnings growth, the ones with the good-looking teeth and coiffed hair and the abs, the six-pack abs and the pectoral muscles that bulge. They're on the cover of GQ and Vogue and Vanity Fair. Dividends are a secondary concern. They usually have high price-to-earnings ratios. Why? In expectation of higher earnings in the future. And the growth stocks are stars. Everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon as a company is experiencing strong growth. Subsequently, the stock price is bid up to very high levels. So typically, they are also the stocks that are the riskiest, because when the slightest hint of a slowdown in the growth appears, what happens? The stock price is often brutally punished. So be careful. I'm not trying to say we shouldn't be interested in growth. We should be interested in growth. But when it's taken to its ultimate extreme, where there's no price too high because this company is growing, right, we can get burned. Right. Slide 88. The aggressive growth strategy. And you see how some of these are linking in back to the mutual fund categories? Right. Sometimes called speculation, short-term trading. The investor aggressively trades in and out of stocks in order to achieve eye-catching returns instead of waiting 3 to 5 years for a stock to move. An aggressive stock trader would go after the same investment return in 6 months to a year or less. Some traders have time horizons in the weeks or days. And now, folks, there are companies who are using computers to make millions of trades per day. Whoops, it should be millions of trades per day. I got to fix that. What? Yeah, what I've read on this, folks, is that we shouldn't allow it. I mean, the regulators have this stock answer. In fact, I got to put that up on the website. These regulators have this stock answer saying, yes, well, it does have its benefits. It increases liquidity and what else? Offers a profound strategy for pricing securities, but there are certainly abuses of this, and we're keeping our eyes out. Balderdash! There's no reason, no economic reason, in my humble opinion, for the good of our economy, for you to be making millions of trades per day. And the reason they get away with this is because, I don't know. I don't know the reason they get away with this. They're just, ugh. And so I'm gonna find that thing written, that little piece written by FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, and stick it up there on the webpage. Aggressive growth. This is the strategy, let's read at the bottom. This is the strategy that many people think they are supposed to use when they start investing in stocks. Oh, folks, it is not easy. It is fraught with perils and drawbacks, not the least of which are the serious transaction costs that can be generated as a result of frequent trading. Right? You got to pay a commission. Stockbrokers simply adore stockers. Oh, I'm sorry, I mean investors. Wrong. Speculators who use this strategy. And this is what I don't understand. How can these people making millions of trades not be paying huge transaction costs? Well, obviously, you know, they have some kind of in on the market that allows them to do what you and I couldn't do, because we'd be hit with huge commissions. So I'm not a big fan of this. We'll see where it goes over the next few years. Slide 8. So are you going to be an aggressive growth speculator? I hope not. This is the strategy I think people expect to do when they get $15,000 from an inheritance, and then they think, oh, I'm going to go play the market. Lots of luck. Slide 89. Contrarian strategy. Now, here's something that warrants our attention, but it ain't easy. It's investing in stocks that are out of favor with the market for some reason, as reflected by low price-to-earnings ratios and low prices compared to their fundamentals. And what are those? You know, the numeric measures that we use to value a company and look at its reasonable expectation of returns in the future, which we'll start learning in Chapter 6. Contrarian investors actively seek stocks from companies with sound financial statements that the market has undervalued for whatever reason. And I got this quote from a contrarian investor. I always try to be accommodating. I buy when others want to sell, and I sell when others want to buy. Yeah, you see? But the problem is, it's difficult to do. Let's read at the bottom. Being a contrarian is difficult since historically, what? The market rises about 3 times as much as it falls. So you have to be willing to basically sit on your hands and wait for those times when the market really falls precipitously or really skyrockets precipitously. Because if you continue to sell as people are buying, you're basically going to run out of things to sell. You're going to be all in cash. And here's another contrarian quote from an interview. He basically said, Howard Marks, he basically said, it's not a steady business. It's not a steady business, when asked what it was like to be a contrarian. And people like Warren Buffett are contrarians. Throughout the 2000s, he simply sat on his hands and waited until 2008. And then when the organic matter hit the ventilating device, he jumped in with a ton of cash and bought, I forget how much, $5 or $10 billion worth of GE, $5 or $10 billion worth of Goldman Sachs. Why? Because he could. They were hard up for cash, and so they sold pieces, big chunks of themselves. Goldman Sachs eventually paid them back and said, "Thank you very much. We don't want your monkey on our backs anymore." He got tremendous deal. He was able to get shares that paid a different classification of shares. Remember the different classifications, right? He got his own classification of shares that paid 10% dividends. 10% dividends before anybody else was paid. You see, that's how hard up, so to speak, the folks at Goldman Sachs were for cash, that they were willing to basically say, all right, we'll pay you 10%. And then to pay them back, they had to pay a fee. They had to pay a fee, to like a prepayment penalty. So you see, contrarians can do very, very well, but they have to be willing to sit back and just relax and wait just for the right time when the markets are way, way overvalued or way, way undervalued. Slide number 90. Ugh. I call these dumb, and dumber. Sector rotation. Your job is to buy stocks in hot sectors and sell stocks in stale ones. But you have to decide which sectors are hot, and you have to decide which are stale. And then you think this sector is going to be the next hot one, and so you stick with it, and then it turns out that it's not that hot, and you move it to the one that was hot just in time for the one that was not doing very well to turn hot, and the one that was hot to turn stale. Momentum investing. It's another form of aggressive investing. You buy stocks as they go up, you sell stocks as they go down, often involves selling stocks short, which is a way to make money when stocks go down. We made just a quick mention of this. We'll take a look at it in detail at the end. This momentum investing uses the greater fool theory. Huh? You buy high, sell higher. Somewhere out there, there is a greater fool than I. And that person will buy my shares. Does this sound familiar? This is what was going on in the housing market several years ago. 2003 to 2007, started about 2002 or so. Flip this house. It's great. It's like musical chairs. It's great while the music is playing. But as soon as the music stops, yeah. And then market timing. And we've already made mention of market timing. We talked about mutual funds. Folks, just forget it. Just forget it. You're not going to do it. And here's a very famous investor from the mid-20th century, Bernard Baruch. He said, don't try to buy at the bottom or sell at the top. It can't be done except by liars. You know, the same people who caught the really big fish and it got away. Can you identify the risks inherent in each of these? Yeah, good luck is all I can say. If you try to do these, I wish you the best of success, and I just shake my head and hope that you don't lose too much money. slide number. In fact, there's a wonderful book, The Liar's Game. Not The Loser's Game. The Liar's Poker, that was the other thing. Charles Ellis. No, some different person. The Loser's Game. I think it's in the bibliography, The Loser's Game. And that's these people who try to do these strategies. They're losers, normally. So, and if they are winners, well, then they're the same people who can hit the fastball at 98 miles an hour. Slide number 91. Which strategy do you favor? And of course, in the face-to-face class, everybody says, oh, buy and hold. Why? Because I told everybody that that's my favorite. But no, you have to decide. You have to decide. The cool thing about buy and hold, folks, for most of us working grunts, is because it's what we can do. We don't have a ton of cash to swoop in when the market falls precipitously. We're not going to be watching three video screens at once trying to buy and then sell within 10 minutes. It's just not going to happen. But we do have $50 or $100 a month to stick into the market every month from our paycheck or whatever. So, enough said. Slide number 92. Wow. Yeah. We're finished with our introduction to stocks, discussing the stock market, the different types of stocks, buying and selling securities, market capitalization, all the things that we've discussed. Now, I want you to go back. Yes, I do. I want you to go back and review these things every day because you really need to know these. So if somebody comes up to you and says, what is an odd lot? Is that anything to do with Odd Job from the James Bond movie? You need to be able to tell them. And if you can't tell them, they're going to say, well, didn't you take Business 123 Introduction to Investments with Professor Payano at Southwestern Community College? Boy, he must not be a very good professor. You see, I'm worried about me. I want you to do well so I look good. Is that a deal? And we both look good. All right, go back and do this again. Our next chapter, folks, we enter the inner sanctum of common stock valuations. Oh, boy. The heart of our course. See ya!